Tonight we're going to be looking at one of the Buddha's teachings called the Five Aggregates. And it's a teaching that's part of a collection of mindfulness teachings called the Satipatthana Sutta. And the Five Aggregates are one part of this teaching. It's not that many pages long, but there's a lot of different teachings in this. This teaching of the Five Aggregates. And I want to start with a teaching from my teacher, the Venerable Ajahn Sumedho, around what's true and what's not true. And he says, this is Sumedho speaking, "One time I went to see a teacher who said that we don't need the discipline or the Vinaya rules." So the discipline meaning the rules that the monastics live by, it's called the Vinaya. This teacher said to him, "All you have to do is be mindful. Mindfulness is enough. Mindfulness is enough." After this sit, I took you through how this compassionate mindfulness, this wisdom and mindfulness, that's all we need in one sense. So this teacher is saying, yeah, that's all we need, saying to the Venerable Sumedho. And when he says to a teacher, he would mean another monastic, most likely in Thailand. So the Sumedho goes on. "So I went back and I told Ajahn Chah." Ajahn Chah is his teacher. "So I went back and told Ajahn Chah, and Ajahn Chah said, 'True, but not right. Right, but not true. True, but not right. Right, but not true.' This is a very useful reflection. True, but not right. Right, but not true. In both Dharma understandings and psychological understandings, in our personal interactions with one another, where we can have a view or be taught an understanding or be an interpretation psychologically, our very strong feelings about the history of something, it can be true but not right. It can be right but not true." So what might this mean, true but not right? If in fact one was completely mature in one's mindfulness, that's all you would need. So it's true, but it's not right for right now. We need, in language terms, in our own layman terms, we do need discipline. We do need renunciation. We need following the precepts of wise behavior, because our mindfulness is not yet full enough to be relied upon by itself. We need the techniques of meditation. Mindfulness alone would not be enough. We need the meditation because we can only develop our mindfulness with the help of meditation techniques. So it's true, but not right, because it doesn't capture the situation we're in, that mindfulness is enough. In the same way, it's right, but it's not true. It's right that mindfulness is enough. I just described that, as I said earlier. But it's not true that right now mindfulness is enough. It's right. It's not saying something that's wrong, but it's lacking in completion because it's not including the time space of here and now. So it may be right, but it's not true here and now. Once it's placed in time, in the context of time, it's not true. It's not true in the way of a lived truth. Do you get this sort of? So we can each reflect in this coming week about something that we feel very strongly, a view we have that may be true, that's not really right. Or something that's, yes, you're really right, but it's not true for this situation. Yes, it's right to say they shouldn't be acting that way. But it's not true that they have a choice. So yes, they should not have said that to you. They should not treat you that way. But they may not have a choice. So many different ways to apply this. The five aggregates are a way of looking at what makes up a moment's experience. In the Buddhist psychology, in the Buddhist teaching, every moment is made up of a series of parts, and that without each of those parts, that moment would not be occurring in the mind. This is presented as a teaching that one can see for oneself. Is this true or not? So it's presented for us to look and see. And if we find that is true, then we see there's implications of that. So these five aggregates, or five parts, start with rupa, or this material form, that there's some material form that of an experience. And then we have a feeling about that, that's this little flavoring of it's either pleasant or unpleasant, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Every mind moment has got this little flavoring. It's either pleasant or unpleasant, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Mostly what we notice is the pleasant and the unpleasant. There's exceptions to that, particularly in practice. As practice, the mind gets really subtle, but in general, in walking around experience, very much so. So there's this material form, there's feeling, and then there's cognition. So we have an experience, and we know it because of the feeling tone, and that feeling tone gets our attention, so we cognize it. We cognize it, we recognize, oh, I'm having this experience. Right now, just in my body, I have some pain in the left side of my jaw. I have a little bit of sense of unbalance in my body, a little bit of twist in the body in the left side. I'm aware of the your attention in this room. Each of those, it's pleasant or unpleasant, and I'm cognizing that that's true in my mind. In my mind, that's what my mind is having. My mind's knowing this experience. It may not be true in some objective way, but that's my subjective experience. And then the fourth of the aggregates is volition, how I'm relating to this experience. So how am I relating to the discomfort in my jaw? How I'm relating to this little imbalance between left and right. How am I relating to your attention on my words? How am I relating to that? Oh, and a mosquito just showed up also, so I just had a little buzzing in the ear. So how am I relating to each of these experiences? What is my reaction to experience? And then the last of the aggregate is consciousness. Consciousness is that registering of this moment of it becoming known to us. So cognition is the knowing, but without that moment of consciousness, this, when again, consciousness can't happen without all of these other things, we have the experience. So every moment, there's these five things happening together. Again, there's different levels of experience of this with depending on how subtle the mind gets. The pointing out of this is of value, first of all, because we recognize in the felt experience of the moment through any sense gates, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. All of these, the mind, thoughts itself, they're just thoughts, that each of these, through each sense gate, all five of these aggregates come together and make a moment. That is our subjective experience. Sometimes these aggregates are taught in terms of this, that they together constitute the parts that create clinging. That these five aggregate parts create a moment of clinging in the mind. The mind clings because these five things come together. So as we have a felt sense of each of these, we're able to recognize them. We can see their nature, and as we see their nature, that makes us more able to be skillful in relation to each of them. We see them more clearly. Thus, mindfulness is what we need. Mindfulness is enough in that way. We're mindful of, oh, there's been some sort of contact. We're mindful that, oh, this is feeling pleasant or unpleasant. And we're mindful that there's a that we're just being aware of something here, and we're just being aware of it. We may be in the way we're being aware of it may be from an old view. We can't trust just because we're aware of this that we're having a we're recognizing something that we're seeing it correctly. It could not be, it doesn't mean we're seeing it correctly. It's our subjective experience of it. That's what we're seeing. So you may be someone at work that's been a difficult person, and they say something, and you perceive it as an act of unpleasantness towards you. Or there they are being bitchy again, or whatever it is. That is your perception in that moment. But that doesn't mean that's what that person is doing. It's so often that we, as we become mindful, we become aware of how much we are projecting due to past conditionings, the reality of the moment that we're projecting. That we don't know if this is true or not, our perception. And that's really freeing there alone. And then we start to see our volition, our how our intention is to how we're relating to this experience. And we see the ways that we relate to experience that are that cause us suffering, cause us to grasp all or not. So taking the person at work that we perceive as being nasty to us in this moment, we know that they may be being nasty or not. We can't trust our impression right away. But whether they're being nasty or not, we know what's a wise way to relate. That's the volition, this willfulness of relation, the intentional way of relating to the moment. This is where our freedom is, if nowhere else. So we start to see that in a moment's experience, there's all these different places. If it's just contact, if it's just pleasant or unpleasant, we can already have a lot of spaciousness around it. There's that difficult person at work. But it's just contact. It's just pleasant or unpleasant. We become free of that person's power to affect us so much because we see it clearly as just a moment's experience. We don't buy into the whole thing. Do you see? We don't buy into the narrative. We don't buy into the narrative. Our narrative may be pretty accurate, or it may not be accurate right now, but if we don't buy it in the first place, it's just unpleasant. It's just a moment of contact through the hearing gate. So, it's just a moment of contact. The heart can stay open. The mind doesn't have to contract. But all of these different points where we can have a freedom around our experience so that we start to break the conditioned reactivity of the mind that creates the dukkha. Very practical. Very practical. And again, we can see for ourselves, you're not supposed to believe anything. You kind of go out and check it out and see. The teaching is that through this knowing of the five aggregates, we start to see the impersonal nature of our personal experience. And seeing that impersonal nature of our personal experience we have more space around it. We become more free in mind and heart. Said another way, that the knowing how conditioned the moment is, we become detached from it to the degree that we don't buy it. We don't believe, oh no, this is what it is. We don't get attached. We are detached. We have non-attachment that leads to dispassion. Where it's dispassion. Oh, it's just unpleasant. And in that, there starts to be this freedom from these, what are sometimes referred to as the five subjective aspects of our personality. Now, these aggregates, don't worry about the Pali words, but they're called khandhas, so you might hear them as the five khandhas sometimes. They apply to past experience just as much as present. So a memory from the past, still made up of five aggregates. A thought about the future, still made up of five aggregates. So all moments in time are made up of these five aggregates. The rupa is sometimes it's been referred to as these organic sensations, and it's been defined as whatever can be affected by external conditions is one way to understand the rupas. I was actually going to read you, and I forgot to do so, the Buddha's direct words in all of this. Here are the Buddha's instructions. She knows such as material form, such its arising, such as passing away, such as feeling, such as arising, such as passing away, such as cognition, such as arising and passing away of cognition, of each of these, such are volitions, such are their arising, such as their passing away, such as consciousness, such as its arising, such as its passing away. Just seeing them in terms of arising and passing, all of these conditions. So after rupa, there is this feeling, the feeling, a tone, the feeling flavoring of any moment through any of the six sense organs. And it is in this feeling that there's so much subjectivity of pleasant and unpleasant. You can start out really thinking a stimulation is pleasant, and then over time you get interested in it, and it's sort of neutral, and you don't pay much attention to it. And then if it persists, it can become very unpleasant, or just the opposite. At IMS, the Insight Meditation Society back in Massachusetts, where I did most of my long sits of, 6 weeks or 3 months or something like that, there used to be, and they took them out to my regret, these old radiators, which particularly in the early morning would clang. And people would really complain about that at first because it interfered. It wasn't quiet and just clanging. But as you sat there day after day, week after week, they started to have this other feeling tone. They would become very pleasant to the point that this woman as we were nearing the end of the 3 month retreat, held up her hand during the Q&A period in the morning and said, would it be possible for you to make a recording of the radiators? Because I want to use them to help me sit at home. Pleasant and unpleasant, ever changing. Cognition is related to each of the sense gates, in terms of of the features of that object. So feeling tone is kind of how we're relating, but cognition is what it is. It's like, okay, so right now going back to my experience in my upper left side of my jaw. The what of it is that it's got a kind of low grade thudding kind of feeling. There's a kind of prickling. There's kind of a vibration. Little waves of sharpness will come through at times. And there's like an echo that goes into the inner ear. That's the what of the experience. The how I'm relating to it is that the flavoring is unpleasant. It's just unpleasant, and it's just those parts that I named. So the volition is our intentions in terms of how we're relating to the experience. So my intention in terms of relating to this experience in my jaw is one of dispassion. I don't want to be demanding that it be other than it is. Why would I not want to demand that it be other than it is? Because I can't actually do anything about it.
Right.
So my demanding that it be other than it is would be dukkha. Do you see that? And my contracting into that, my being attached, it shouldn't be this way. I have access to good medical care. It shouldn't be this way. That's maybe right, but it's not true. Or it's true, but it's not right. Do you see how immediate this is of experience? This is not a big philosophy. This is the way to freedom in the here and now. It's true enough, that view, but it's not right. It's right, but it's not true for this moment. It doesn't apply to this moment. It doesn't include the here and now enough. So I don't have an attachment. My volitional relationship is deliberately one of non-attachment. It's just like it is. That's enough. And that brings a kind of dispassion. My experience of this moment is very little defined by the experience in this jaw. It's very little defined. It is characterizing the moment, but it is not defining it. There's so many other things defining this moment, just including the pleasantness of the air right now. It's much more of defining this moment than the unpleasantness of this experience. Not always going to be true, but so much of the time when the mind is not contracted, unpleasant or wanting the pleasant does not define the moment. It is one of the characteristics of this moment, but it's not defining it. In a very real way, none of this is magic. It's all practice. So we can see that our intention, volition equals intention, how we're relating to the moment is coming from a reactive state of mind or a responsive state of mind. I've taught this in here so many times through the years that some of you go, oh, I can't hear this again. We cannot hear it too much. And a reactive state of mind, the pleasant or the unpleasant, are like two strings and we're a puppet. Our thoughts, our actions, our words, all being pulled by pleasant and unpleasant. Just because of these five aggregates occurring together. That's not a very interesting dance with life, being pulled by two strings. We can have a responsive relationship to this experience. And that responsive relationship is one of coming from our deeper values. I'm not interested in having this moment defined by having a 3-month infection in my upper jaw based on a botched oral surgery around trying to put an implant in that didn't go right. I'm not interested in being defined by that. That's a very boring way to be. Is it pleasant? Oh, is it getting more unpleasant? Oh, it's unpleasant, but is it really getting more? I want to pay my attention to that. I don't think so. You're much more interesting than that experience. My thoughts are much more interesting than that. My all the other sense experiences, but my sense of ease or not ease is far more interesting than the subjectivity of a moment of unpleasantness. Not always, a certain intensity can take us over, but over time it takes much more intensity to take us over. And that intensity has to last longer. So we start to see that our relationship to the moment, that there's a certain amount of freedom in it through studying these five aggregates. Consciousness is consciousness of something in the teachings of the five aggregates. Mm-hmm. It's being conscious of an object. This word vijnana is also used in other ways. I use awareness for those other ways oftentimes, or I talk about consciousness itself. But here it means consciousness of an object that's arisen in the mind. In the mind, that's arisen in the mind. It's consciousness of that object. And it is consciousness that creates subjective cohesion to our experience. So we're conscious of this, we're conscious of this, we're conscious of this, and one's right next to another. Just like water, drops of water in a stream are right next to one another, our moments of arising and passing of each moment are right next to one another. You can easily observe that for yourself. Just see how fast one moment's knowing is to another, to another. And that subjective cohesion creates the sense of I that we then get so attached to. And we can be so narrow in our sense of I. We can make it so hard and so fast. And we miss this stream of that it's a stream of moments, of cognition. It's a stream of cognition. It's a stream of consciousness. It's a stream of pleasant or unpleasant. All that we can notice them in all those different ways, just one moment or another. So in this teaching of the five aggregates, it's referring both to a single moment and to that stream. Some of these things I'm saying are for people who may have more experience than you. So don't worry about why is he saying that? What is that an implication of that? That comes in time. So in this room is a mixed group of yogis. You're a mixed amount of teaching of exposure to teachings and through reading or hearing or reflection. So I'm layering it for different people in the room and based on your experience. So we can notice the consciousness of a moment, or we can notice, oh, this is the mind stream. Wow. Look at how I'm taking as a solid, unchanging self this mind stream. It's all over the place. This mind stream, and I'm imagining it as unchanging. Woo, that's not very accurate. Whatever it is, it's not unchanging. So I'm relating to it in all these different ways. I relate to one moment this way, I relate to the next moment the other way. Here's the same arising of a thing in my mind, and I'm relating to it in all these different ways. That's not a fix. There's not fixity in that. Well, so if there's not fixity, then maybe I do have more choice, that I can be relating to experience in a way that has more freedom of mind heart than less. There is this possibility of how we're relating to dukkha, just the way the Buddha said, dukkha meaning the unsatisfactoriness, the unreliability, the stress of the moment, the suffering of the moment. There is choice here, there's possibility here. Maybe not available now, but as I keep practicing, it can become available to me. That's really a possibility. Cognition is what understands the meaning of an experience, and it combines our past experience of memory, association, and all to make up. And we make up a reality, and it uses labels. Oh, this is a person. This is this nastiness of personalities like this. And we've got a category that nastiness of personality is a certain thing to us. Or friendliness is the thing. It's we have a concept of friendliness, and then we have a moment's experience, and the mind, just by its nature, its cognitive nature, will label, oh, that's being friendly. Now, we can be very wrong in this, right? What we take as friendliness is, in fact, you know, a setup of somebody wanting something from us. they want to sell you, you know, that whatever TV or whatever it may be. So we start to see that just because we're making a meaning out of it, that meaning is not necessarily to be trusted. It's to be further explored. Likewise, the Vedana, the feelings, create this affect of positive or negative. And again, maybe reliable, maybe not. It is the volition, our intention towards the moment, that either ignores what's arisen, or evaluates it, or investigates it, or connects it to our values, or doesn't bother connecting to our values, and just goes with the stimulation. So all of these activities that make up of an experience coming just from these five aggregates. One way of saying this, and those of you with a lot of experience, you may not have ever heard this before, so you don't have to write this down, but just take this in if you can. The material says where I am. So the material feeling of my pelvis in this chair tells me where I am. The I consciousness tells me I am in this room. The sounds locate me in this room. My sounds locate me in this room. The materiality through any of these five sense gates, six if you count them, mind. The feelings tell me how I am. Oh, I'm feeling pretty good right now. Oh, I'm a little tired right now. The feeling tone gives us a sense of how I am. This is very useful to notice this. So I'll say again, the materiality says where I am. Well, I'm in this room. The feeling tone says how I am. Well, I'm feeling pretty good. Oh, I'm a little tired. Oh, I'm restless. It all comes out of this pleasant to unpleasantness. The cognition says what I am in this moment. What I am. Oh, I'm a human being. It goes on with that. Volition says why I am, why I'm acting the way I am acting in this moment. My volition says why I am, in terms of why I'm doing what I'm doing right now. So when you go, well, why am I saying this to my sibling on the phone? That's relating to the volition in this moment. What's your intention in this moment? How I am is saying, well, how am I doing talking to my sibling in this moment? Where I am is the felt sense of that telephone and hearing the voice over this wire, over this in the air, is where I am. I'm on the phone. What I am is I'm a person hearing right now. I'm listening to this person. I'm perceiving this person. This is the cognition of this. I'm cognizing. I'm perceiving my sibling talking on the phone right now. This is what's going on in this moment, these kinds of things. And then consciousness is whereby I know that I am. I am having this experience because I'm conscious of it. So in some level I'm having this experience. Even if it's delusional, I'm conscious of the delusion of this experience. I may not recognize, the cognition may not be strong enough to recognize that it's delusional, but I am conscious that I'm having this experience. This is so useful, understanding these different things that are making up a moment like this. So one of the things that often happens to people in the hospital, I have a family member in the hospital right now, and she doesn't have access to the teachings of the five aggregates. And so when she has a moment of consciousness, she believes that consciousness, rather than going, no, I'm experiencing this right now, but it doesn't mean that it's really true. She trusts every moment of consciousness as though it were really true. And yet she's under some heavy medication right now. So lots of times, many people, maybe you yourself in a hospital, where you're having all of these, if you trust those experiences, it leads you to actions that are not skillful. People end up being tied down in their hospital bed because they're believing their consciousness. People come on retreat. On rare occasion, someone on retreat will get to believing a moment of consciousness, even though others are telling them otherwise, and there's people that are carrying around them. They're believing something because it's arising in the consciousness, and they can't let loose of that belief, and it's not true at all. And we then have to respond to that as wisely and kindly as we can. As we start to see the way that experience is aggregated together, our ego identification starts to be less hard and fixed. This doesn't make the ego less healthy. It can make the ego more healthy. It has a more resilience when it's not so rigid. Oh, I'm a failure is a rigid view of the ego. I can't stand this anymore, one more moment. And we develop thoughts of annihilation. That's a rigid ego. If we understand each moment is always arising and passing, that it's made up of these parts, and that these parts are not necessarily the way we would always view them, the way we're viewing them right now, we're more able to be in the moment without contracting in the same way. The recognition of the aggregate nature of a moment's experience can at first be, first we can really resist it because our ego thinks that we got to have that fixed view. That's understandable. Nothing wrong with the ego. It has not yet learned that there's a larger possibility. But in time, as we understand the subjective, very conditional nature of experience, it gives us a new humility. Is what I'm feeling right now true or not true? I am feeling it, but is it true or not true in the way I'm interpreting it? Don't know so much. There's a humility to this. It's not what we learned that we can't control things we think we can control or should be able to control. We develop a more humility in relation to our subjective experience. We don't believe our views, even though we have views. We don't believe them. We don't hold them. Our values we can hold, but not our views. And then we also, as we stay, have this more of this deeper humility in our relation to experience, it brings a kind of wisdom. Because we say, oh, I don't have to know this way. We start to have more space, as I've described over and over again. But we also get this other wonderful thing. And that is a kind of dignity. Because we are more in the reality of what's true in this moment. We have a dignity that we are showing up for this moment as best we're able. We don't have to be rigid. We don't have to be grasping in our relationship to the feeling tone, to the cognition, to the volition. And it gives us a kind of dignity. The dignity comes and is not separate from that humility. We know as best we know. I will respond to this moment talking to my sibling, to the difficult person in the office, to receiving praise, to dealing with physical pain as best I am able. My understanding of it is less than complete. It's going to change in my own knowing of it in this very next moment anyway. So that the dignity is in our showing up for our experience rather than our controlling our experience of rather than claiming this fixed interpretation of it. Some feeling of that? It makes such a difference if we start to feel that. I am teaching the March retreat, the month of March, Spirit Rock. I emphasize this in almost every talk, this combination of humility and dignity. Because I've marveled for many, many years. I remember in the Appalachian Mountains when the various jobs I had, and I worked almost always, how some people seemed to have a dignity and others didn't. There were people, it was a very strided society based on economic class. And I bet some people that were in the out class in terms of economics and education and all, they had this innate dignity. And I so admired that. I wanted that. And now, it didn't mean that people in a higher class didn't have that, but a lot of people had a false sense of I'm important that really didn't have any real dignity to it. Likewise with school teachers. Some school teachers had this own, they had their own dignity, and they would come and interact with a student from their own dignity and give you dignity. But not most. Not most. Their dignity in part was based on their having power over. Because real dignity is power within itself. And being humiliated means that the dignity is false. Because when we're really when we have humility, we can't be humiliated because there's not anything like that. We can be embarrassed by ourselves. We can find it very funny, or whatever it may be. But it's not the experience is very different. And again, the extreme of experience can change this because trauma has its own thing. So I'm not making a universal statement because you can have anything from. Sexual abuse, particularly when you're young, but any sexual abuse, to being robbed, you can have a sense of invasiveness, of being penetrated, that at first it has this sense of being humiliated. But over time, as we stay with those experiences, we can actually regain a kind of humility in relation to it that brings back our dignity, even in relation to something that was really traumatic. It may take us years to get over. I'm not being lied about this. But this formula of the Buddha's, this teaching, this process, this way of how to relate to the moment, I have found to be really, really reliable. And then to end this reflection, this exploration of the five aggregates, I wanted to read the Venerable Sumedha's conclusion to his little teaching around what's true and what's right. And he says, the aim of Buddhist meditation, then, is to let go of the conditions of the mind, these conditions formed by the five aggregates. The aim of Buddhist meditation, then, is to let go of the conditions of the mind. This doesn't mean denying, getting rid of, or judging them. We're not trying to get rid of any of these five aggregates. This doesn't mean denying, getting rid of, or judging them. It means not believing them or following them. Instead, we listen to them as Dhamma, as conditions of the mind that arise and cease. We learn to trust in just being the listener, the watcher, with an attitude of awakened, attentive awareness, rather than being somebody trying to meditate, trying to get some result. Then through mindfulness, we're able to get beyond the conditioning of the mind to the pure consciousness that isn't conditioned, but which is like the background, the emptiness, the blank sheet on which words are written. Our perceptions arise and cease on that blank sheet. That is emptiness. This pure consciousness, this mind, when the mind is not filled in any given moment with the five aggregates arising, this unconditioned awareness that is our natural heritage, which is a whole talk in itself. So, any question or comment about the five aggregates?
Well, Thich Nhat Hanh teaches form, feeling, perception, mental formation, and consciousness.
Same thing.
Same thing.
Same thing, yes. Form is the rupa, right. Yes.
Everywhere in the suttas that I've read refers to the five aggregates subject to clinging.
Yes.
And is it possible to have five aggregates not subject to clinging?
Yes. Well, those five aggregates are the reasons for, as I would understand the teaching, that if the mind is not clinging, then the five aggregates are still there, but they're not leading to this consequence of clinging. And that is what the mindfulness does, is break that illusionary relationship that causes those five aggregates to create clinging. So you can have great dispassion, and the five aggregates are still there, but the mind is not caught in clinging. Just as when there's no hindrances in the mind, there's not clinging. This, you could even understand this as maybe, I won't say that, but it's the same. I'll just leave it as the same as. If the five aggregates are clearly seen and not identified with, there's not clinging in the mind.
Is that what choiceless awareness is?
Choiceless awareness is when we're willing to let the mind be with whatever is arising, and we're cultivating in that choiceless awareness a kind of mindfulness that leads to seeing that in whatever the mind goes, that there's no reason to get identified with these five aggregates. Choiceless awareness is when in meditation we're not directing the mind to an object, or even to relating to an object in a certain, to not directing the mind to an object. So whatever object arises, we become mindful of that object. Now here's another object, now here's another object. And our mindfulness goes with one object after another. And we don't mind what object is, because we're always seeing it in terms of Dhamma. That's what choiceless awareness is seeing it all. And as best we're able right now, seeing the Dhamma in this moment, no matter, so we're not having to stay with the breath to see it, to be relating to it from Dhamma. We can be with anything. The mind's gotten still enough and trained enough to be able to be with choiceless awareness in this way. That makes sense to you?
So I have never understood rupa. What I don't understand is the material form. So my question is, can rupa be a physical pain, a sound, a verbal threat, a look, a thought, and a concept? If so, then I understand.
Then you do understand it.
Wow, really?
Yes, you do understand it. Now, it's very confusing at first.
Well,
but
this is really hard.
Yes, all of those things. All of those things through any sense door.
Okay.
Any sense door, including the mind itself. Really? It's all rupa.
So the five sense gates, these five aggregates,
they arise in relation to the sense gate.
That's right. So each one can have its own.
The experience coming from any of the sense gates are made up of these five aggregates, including thought itself. It's self-generating. The mind just generating thought. It too has these five aggregates.
And this can all be at once.
All the five aggregates are arising at once. We're breaking them down in order to see clearly. But they're all, for a moment of consciousness to occur, the other four have to be present.
So we got five times five, or actually six because of the mind.
Let's don't get into all of that.
That's how complicated it is.
There's a whole complicated teaching about that, but we don't need that.
So could rupa be considered objects of perception, what is perceived, or?
Yes, if what's being perceived, yes. Yes, there's more to add to that, but yes. Okay, the good questions. Thank you for those questions. I'm sure it helped others in the room. So we're going to sit for a few minutes, and then we'll do the metta, and then we'll end.